Hi, I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of April 12, 2013. It's spring and the best time to sell a house, but it's going to take more than a little sunshine to grab buyers' attention.
Buyers in a condition that I call buyers stupid, they're leading their own lives, they're trying to sell their house, they're raising their kids, they have the attention span of a gnat. If there's one thing that pulls their emotional attention away from that house, we've lost them. And basically all we're trying to keep them from doing is saying no.
The housing market's up, the economy's improving, even the weather's getting better. But before you get too happy, it's tax time. Don't panic. We're putting a positive spin on filing this season, and we're even making it rhyme.
Alas, 'tis the time to file my tax. Let's see if I can deduct the max.
In this, the anxious time of year, when taxes loom before our eyes, I sit with Marketplace in my ears and ponder payments as advised.
All that and more on Marketplace Money from APM. Oh yes, it's tax time. And this year, what with the new tax laws and a Monday filing deadline, even more of you than usual are crunching numbers right now. I hope we're not interrupting. But let's not start with taxes. Why not something to lighten the mood? How about some happy housing numbers? We keep hearing the housing market is back. Now we're actually seeing some positive effects on the economy. More new homes are going up, and builders and roofers and window installers and home improvement stores are all hiring. Used homes are selling too, in many markets, and they're going fast, sometimes at or above asking, at least if it's a nice house with clean title and all spiffed up for sale. How much to spend, though, on those last repairs? We sent Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to find out.
Hey, how are you?
Are you Chris?
I am.
Good to meet you.
Hi.
Good to meet you as well.
Real estate broker Chris Suarez has been showing this $425,000 Victorian townhouse in Portland, Oregon. The owner spent thousands on improvements, a new gas fireplace, baby nursery, wine nook in the finished basement. That's a change.
2 years ago and 3 years ago, I was recommending don't put money into your home. If you're in a situation where you need to sell and it's the right thing for you to do, then let's try to get as much equity out as we possibly can.
But Suarez says in many markets, investing in home improvements does make sense now. The reason? Home prices are rising again. And more homeowners who had been sitting on the sidelines are finally deciding to sell. Suarez says you want your house to be in better condition than the one down the block with a for sale sign.
It's more a condition war. So you're putting in that money so that you show up well based on what other product is out there in the market.
Investment analyst Michael Farr says now the thing homeowners have to figure out is which improvements to plow their cash into.
People want to know that if they invest more money in their homes to repair or refurbish, that they're going to be able to get that money out, that it's going to be worth it.
Turns out there is a way to figure out what's worth it. It's called the Cost Value Report, published annually in Remodeling Magazine. We'll put a link on our website. It can tell you how much you're likely to recover at sale time if you put in a really upscale kitchen for $100,000 versus a no-frills one at half the price. Sunrooms, home offices, and bathroom additions get the lowest return, often less than 50%. And the biggest bang for the buck? Stuff that increases curb appeal, like a nice entryway. Here's the catch, though. You're not ever likely to get back 100% of what you put in when you sell. But realtor Chris Suarez says your house isn't just an asset that you're going to sell eventually. You have to live in it now.
You know, sometimes, and this is the unfortunate part, a seller does everything right weeks before they put it on the market when then they realize that they've never really got to enjoy it.
When you are ready to sell, though, best not do renovations out of house love, says Justin Reardon. He stages homes for sale in Portland.
The idea of doing a bathroom the way you would want it to be done, you should never do that because of all the people in the world that might buy your house, you are not one of them.
So this stuff is all going to slide over to the house tomorrow, so I'm the master?
Yes.
Reardon's firm, Spade and Archer Design, will completely furnish a vacant property like this $800,000 mid-century colonial. His decorating touches include vintage ice skates on the mantelpiece. Reardon's made a study of home buyer behavior. He's sort of a pop real estate psychologist.
Buyers in a condition that I call buyers stupid, they're leading their own lives, they're trying to sell their house, they're raising their kids, they have the attention span of a gnat. If there's one thing that pulls their emotional attention away from that house, we've lost them. We have 5 to 7 minutes to win them over, and basically all we're trying to keep them from doing is saying no.
Want more of Reardon's rules for getting to yes? Don't leave out any prescription drugs, alcohol, firearms, political posters, no fur, live or stuffed, or mirrors on the ceiling. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, I guess we better settle down and get to taxes. Midnight Monday, of course, is the deadline to file. This hour, we're looking at taxes from all sorts of perspectives. A little later in the show, we'll talk about tax policy around the world and how it stacks up against our own. But to start us off, here's a very personal view on the whole business from someone right in the trenches.
Hi, my name is Michelle Knight. I'm a CPA and owner of Knight Accounting and Technology in Keystone, Colorado. Very few people in this world wake up in the morning excited to go do tax returns. After 10 years in this job, and I'm only 34, so I guess I've been doing this now a third of my life, I actually do wake up every morning excited to go to work. And the reason is I'm truly helping people. Of course, there's the bad days, the phone calls where I have to tell someone they owe $60,000 and they pass out. But there's so many good days. I make most of my income by April of each year, so the rest of the year I get to stay home with my kids and have a good time. It really is a great profession. So tax return pricing, I personally have a price list, and it's per form. So if you have a Schedule C, I'm going to tell you that's going to cost between $85 and $175. Whether we state this or not, accountants have little extra charges they throw in for the people that make their lives more difficult. So if somebody arrives with everything tied out in a nice, neat pile, the price is going to be cheaper than somebody that arrives with a shoebox. We might not put that in writing. We might not state that up front. However, it's jokingly in the industry, it's called a PETA fee, pain in the fill in the blank. If you make our life more difficult, if you end up calling a month later and say, oh, whoops, I forgot these three things, then we're going to call it the remailing fee or the reprinting fee. The more easy you make your accountant's life, the cheaper your price will be. I did actually have, for the first time this year, somebody that called and said their dog ate their 1099. So I honestly didn't charge for that excuse because that was just cracked me up. So if you also make me smile, sometimes your price is a little cheaper as well. You know, there's always some pretty memorable clients. For instance, someone that works in a hair salon that insists that they get to deduct their hair and nails because they're in the industry. And they would talk to the other girls in the shop, and everybody would say they were taking the deduction. Well, I looked at a couple returns, and I found out that no one was taking the deductions. What accountants sort of do is shake our heads and smile and nod and say, sure, no problem, we'll take that, and then we never put it on the return. Because, of course, we don't want to get our clients upset, but we also don't want them doing anything illegal.
Certified public accountant Michelle Knight is co-owner of Knight Accounting and Technology with her husband Dave in Keystone, Colorado. Come Tuesday, I hope Michelle might be able to take the day off. And sometime after that, all of our tax dollars will be on their way toward accounts that pay for, well, all those things our taxes pay for, like pensions, police and firefighters, water and sewage and road maintenance. I guess we know where the money goes, but if you've ever driven over a pothole at 40 miles an hour, you've probably wondered how your city prioritizes spending your hard-earned cash. Kevin Clowden keeps an eye on this over at the Milken Institute, where he serves as director of the California Center. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So, come Monday, April 15th, most of us have paid our taxes, and theoretically every state has a big pile of our money somewhere. So what happens then? Where does it go?
Well, depending on the state you live in, it can be very, very different. Some states, a lot of it will stay more locally. A lot of states, like here in California, because property taxes are limited, most of the money actually goes to the state government, who then sort of cycles it around and then sends a bunch of it back locally.
I think it's fair to say that the workings of city and state government is just a mystery to most of us lay people. Now, to get back into understanding the nitty-gritty of where our tax dollars go, let's take tree trimming versus, say, potholes. Where does that get decided?
You've got a couple different parts of the government that makes a decision. The city council at a city level, or usually, you know, the state legislature at the state level, they're the ones who decide what most of the budget priorities are. They're the ones who basically look at it and say, my constituents are worried about schools, you know, or they're worried about parks, or they're worried about sewers or streets. And they'll make a large decision. They'll divide up the pieces of the pie in the budget.
So at this point, does that mean that one municipality might have a larger discretionary fund for their parks than another?
Absolutely. And that can happen with cities right next door to each other. That can happen when cities are created, that you can make a mandate and say, we have to have a certain amount of green space. We have to have a certain amount of money to maintain it. There are a number of more planned cities around the country, particularly in the Sun Belt, where decisions were made early on that they were going to allocate a certain amount of money to public spaces and maintaining them right from the start.
So by the time the decisions come down to the city level, what are they deciding on?
Well, most of the money tends to go to city salaries or to city services or, you know, maintaining parks and roads and things that we expect from year to year to year. And then you have that discretionary budget, that certain amount of money that goes to either fixing problems they've let sit for years or building or doing something new and interesting.
But when the chips are down, say, as they are in bankrupt cities like Stockton here in California and also San Bernardino, then what? How do these cities prioritize what to do with the cash?
Well, the real problem is that cities have to be worried about paying off their creditors first. After all, they're the debtors. That means that city services, your parks, your police, everything else will tend to go by the wayside. Then comes often other big legal obligations like pensions, and that can also be a problem.
Now, obviously, there are a myriad of different laws in every state and every city. But once you account for that, are all cities the same in the sense that there's this master list of priorities?
Usually, it's the essential public services. And if a city goes into bankruptcy, they're going to go and say, look, we have to maintain a minimum level of police, a minimum level of fire, a minimum level of paramedics and ambulance services and trash services and whatever else.
You're an expert. You look at this. Are priorities out of whack?
Well, sometimes they can be. One of the real problems, and this is not knocking public employees, but when cities become convinced that they're doing the best job ever and they start rewarding their employees at a much faster rate than inflation, especially when it comes to pensions and healthcare benefits or even salaries, it can really distort the budget and it can create a lot of problems.
Kevin Clowden is the director of the California Center. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We're going to stay on your case. Monday's tax day. If you're married, at some point your pen might hover above that second paragraph on your 1040. Should you file jointly or separately? Commentator Anne Allstott believes the joint return is obsolete. She thinks we'd be better off without it.
Congress introduced the joint return in the 1940s to ensure families with equal incomes paid equal taxes. Back then, nearly everyone got married. Couples typically married young, had kids early on, and stayed together for the long term. When marriage equaled family, the joint return made sense. Today, only half of American adults are married. Kids may live with married parents, step-parents, or cohabiting parents. More than a third of kids live with single parents. But the tax law seems to be stuck watching reruns of Leave It to Beaver, while the rest of us have long since moved on to modern family. Other countries have already updated their tax laws to reflect the new reality. Most developed nations have adopted individual filing. In countries like Canada and the UK, every person, married or unmarried, pays taxes on his or her own income. It may be tempting to, well, romanticize the joint return, to see in it a symbol of a shared life. But the joint return doesn't reliably reward marriage. Instead, it generates arbitrary tax penalties and bonuses depending on how much each spouse earns compared to the other. Now, later this year, the Supreme Court will rule whether the federal tax law should recognize the marriages of same-sex couples. A favorable ruling would mark a critical victory for marriage equality. But the joint return, with its random marriage penalties and bonuses, is a pretty lousy gift to mark the occasion. Personally, I'm fine with the changing American family. My own modern family includes married, divorced, remarried, and never married couples. But even if you think that America would be better off if more people got married, you shouldn't put your faith in the joint return. A true pro-marriage policy would start with individual filing as a base, and then add marriage incentives provided on equal terms to all married couples.
Anne Allstadt is a professor of tax law at Yale. The decision to file jointly for a married couple may seem simple, but it turns out it's not always to your advantage. For instance, if you or your spouse have significant itemized deductions, you might want to file separately. So in this case, as in many decisions, it pays to dispassionately consider all data and crunch the numbers. We humans, though, aren't known for our cold-blooded, rational decision-making skills. Quite the opposite, in fact. My guests, Chip and Dan Heath, want to change all that. The Heath Brothers' new book is Decisive, How to Make Better Choices in Life and Work. Welcome to Marketplace Money, guys.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Conventional wisdom says that before you make a decision, you should sit down and make a list of pros and cons. But you say that is all wrong. Just throws me off right from the start.
Well, the pros and cons list is a good way of setting up a situation where you've got potentially one option that you're doing thumbs up, thumbs down on. And good decision-making starts with having multiple options available to you. Good decision-making involves collecting information that may contradict your initial opinions, but you can sit at home with your pros and cons list and come up with a beautiful justification for whatever you wanted to do in the first place. And so what we're trying to do is widen out the process of making a good decision.
One of the classic villains of decision-making is what psychologists call narrow framing, and it's this temptation we have to get stuck in thinking about our decisions in a whether or not frame, whether or not I should buy this iPad or whether or not I should quit my job. And what the research tells us is if we can just generate another option, just one or two, it greatly increases the chance we're going to make a good decision. And so with something like retirement, we just can't let ourselves get stuck in this mentality of saying, you know, should I save or not?
Okay, well, let's take that example of retirement, and let's say you've widened your options and you're looking at three or four plans. I'll sell the house, I'll live in an RV, I'll invest in a house with three or four other dear friends to retire with. You get to that point, and then you're stuck. So, what next?
Here's where one of the most important principles of decision-making comes in, and that is we're always wise to trust the experience of other people over our own intuitions. So, for instance, if you're thinking about where you're going to go out to dinner tonight, you might be wise enough to go onto Yelp and look at the reviews and trust the place that has 100 good reviews over your own judgment about which menu looks good. But what's fascinating to Chip and me is when it comes to people's portfolios, they totally throw that logic out the window. So, for instance, most people have their money in a portfolio of stocks and mutual funds. And the reality is, what we know from the research is that millions of people have reviewed mutual funds and stock picking and found it sorely lacking. There was a study of mutual fund performance over a 20-year period, and they looked at every single mutual fund that had more than $100 million in assets under management. Well, only 4% of those funds outperformed a simple, boring index fund like the Vanguard 500. Now, to keep that in perspective, 4%, if you're playing blackjack and the dealer deals you two face cards and your inner idiot shouts, hit me, you've actually got an 8% chance of winning that hand. And so one thing we can learn with our decisions is let's start trusting the actual experience of other people over our own instincts.
So this is all by way of saying that humans are irrational. We go about decision-making in irrational ways, and these are techniques to keep that in check.
Yeah, I think if you think about decision-making, there's a mental spotlight that we have that's really good at focusing on the option that's in front of us. Whatever's in our mental spotlight is more prominent, and what the book is a series of tips about how you move that mental spotlight around to consider other options, to consider information that's not consistent with your initial hypothesis, to look at the future in in a non-rosy way and consider what might go very wrong or what might go very right.
Well, one of the biggest problems in making any decision is being swayed by your emotions. You know, you see that gorgeous midnight blue Mercedes on a car lot and you just can't tear yourself away, even though you know you can only afford a Nissan. Now, you guys write that one effective technique is to get some emotional distance from your decision, or distance at all. How do you do that? The Mercedes is right there.
Part of being a good decision maker is knowing when not to trust yourself. So, you know, if I was on a diet, for instance, and some colleagues of mine were going out to a pizza buffet for lunch, there's just no way I'm going on that trip with them because I don't trust myself to make a good decision in that environment. Often the best thing we can do, especially when it comes to something like saving for retirement, is get out of that emotional melee and create some distance. So for instance, there are a lot of progressive employers these days who have done something brilliant for their employees, and they've set up what I'll call a triple default system for retirement, where a new employee comes in, they're auto-enrolled in the 401k program. They don't have to do anything. And their funds are auto-invested in what's called a target date fund, which creates an appropriate allocation of a portfolio given their age. And they are auto-escalated, which is what it's called when each year that amount that they're investing ratchets up a little bit to keep pace with their raises and the cost of living adjustments. And what's so beautiful about this is it allows people to make good decisions without making good decisions. And it's so much better than the opposite, which is this trap people fall into of tracking their investments on a daily basis, and you follow the stocks up and down, and you start to panic when they dip, and you start to sell too soon when they rise.
So it's like a personal finance way of staying away from temptation, the temptation to blow the money on something else.
Precisely. And, you know, in a weird way, the best retirement strategy may be ignorance is bliss, that we should just get the defaults right and stop paying so much attention.
Dan Heath is a senior fellow at Duke University's Center for the Advancement of Social Entrepreneurship. Chip Heath is a professor at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford University. Their new book is Decisive: How to Make Better Choices in Life and Work. And I'm so glad we decided to have you on the show. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having
Thanks so much for having us.
Do you hear that? The squeals of joy, the howls of despair, the sighs of relief that this whole college application process is finally over. Because by now, most high school seniors know where they got in. But not everyone knows where they're headed yet. It's decision-making crunch time for kids and their parents. By May 1st, they'll have to figure out what they can afford and where they want to spend these next 4 years. 17-year-old high school senior Brian Brusso has been mulling this over with his mom, Jenna, in Chicago, Illinois. And welcome to the show, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Brian, first of all, congratulations on just having options.
Thank you.
So tell us, what were they? What where did you get in?
You know, I had gotten into every school, thankfully, that I applied to, so it wasn't that, I got the denial letter or, you know, anything like that. But I had applied to University of Iowa, UIC in Chicago, Illinois State, Bowling Green State University in Ohio, which is where I had chosen to go.
Western Michigan.
Western Michigan, yes.
Yeah, we were very specific on applying only to the schools that we felt were within our requirements.
And your requirements, you mean financially?
Financially, within the distance that we wanted him to be, and then most importantly, had fields of study that interested Brian.
Brian, did you want to stay close to home?
You know, I did, yes. I didn't want to go too far because I'm the first one going off, and I have a feeling it's going to be a little bit hard the first year. I mean, just like it usually is for many people.
Well, in terms of the financial ins and outs of this, can you give us an idea of the range of your choices, the range of the costs of these schools?
He would be living on campus at all of the schools. So the range would be about between $23,000 and $32,000. $30,000 roughly a year.
And did you get any aid or merit scholarships?
We did not. We did get somewhat of a scholarship from Bowling Green that they give to out-of-state students to help attract them to the school so the out-of-state tuition wouldn't be so overwhelming.
Brian, how were you thinking about the cost of college?
When I first started looking, I wasn't really like, oh, I want to go here. I have my mindset here. So it was really open. So I think it did make it a little bit easier when it came down to financial.
One thing Brian knew early on in terms of a college was he was not attracted to the Big Ten or top 10 schools in terms of the size of students.
Yeah.
So we didn't have colleges generally on there with that huge price tag.
Where does Bowling Green, the college you decided on, fall in terms of cost?
It's going to be right around $27,500 about a year.
Have you applied for loans?
No, we had chosen not to.
At least at this point, we're not.
Jenna, what do you think of that idea that it's maybe a good idea to graduate from college with some money owing?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great idea. In fact, we've always said that we feel the kids will do better if they know that they have some skin in the game, so to speak. So we do expect by the time he graduates to have him responsible for a portion of his education.
Well, thanks so much for joining me, both of you, and for opening up your story to us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Brian and his mom sound like they thought this whole college thing through so well, don't they? They're the lucky ones, though. Right now, some high school seniors and their parents are agonizing over what is one of the biggest financial commitments any of them will ever make. And some need help sorting out the scholarship offers and student loan options and just which school's the right fit for the money. Fortunately, there are certified college planners out there who can help. People like Trevor Ramos. He's with College Funding Remedies, based just up the road from us in Pasadena, California. Trevor, welcome.
Hey, Barbara.
I imagine one of the hardest decisions that high school seniors and their families are facing round about now is how to decide between a dream school and a more affordable option. So where do you tell them to start?
This is definitely an emotional time, and you know the way that this system is structured is that you get accepted to colleges and then you find out how much they cost with only a few weeks to make a decision. Many parents are not aware of what college is going to cost them until this point. There are private student loans and there are government student loans. And if the parent or the student's in a situation where they're looking at private student loans that are upwards of 10-12%, I'd rather them take the decision of going to the school that is going to mitigate some of those loans and so forth. You know, I've had a situation last year. This particular student had already gotten these awards, and his parents were going to have a $40,000 out-of-pocket to go to NYU. And the child was only going to have about a $12,000 out-of-pocket to go to Pepperdine. You know, yes, NYU is a much more prestigious university. Relatively speaking, at that point, it really comes down to the student. And I would say that it's best to take the opportunity that's going to make the college most affordable if they are going to be both good colleges that provide opportunities.
Well, let's talk about that federal student aid. And that goes by the name of the FAFSA form.
Mm-hmm.
The Federal Application for Student Aid. And I remember when I was filling it out with my son last year, a friend told me that he'd filled it out already and had been awarded 21 cents towards mm-hmm. his child's education. This was not a wealthy, mm-hmm. wealthy person.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there are secrets or tricks to the whole process. What don't we parents know about federal aid and filling out that form?
There's also, you know, tricks and so forth, but I think what's important is just clearing up the misunderstandings because, you know, I just had a case where the family was, their income was $100,000, you know, and they had three kids and, you know, after working with this family, they got $52,000 in grants and scholarships and a few student loans. And there, before I met them, they were under the assumption that at $100,000, they weren't going to qualify. The financial aid form is a 74-question form. So just because one factor, you know, stands out doesn't mean that it can't be, you know, divided and subtracted into something that makes sense for them. If the family has, you know, one kid college bound or in college, if their income is over $185,000, they're not going to get the majority of their money from the federal government and the state.
Kids have already gotten their letters. They know where they got in. They also have been given offers. At this point, can they go back and negotiate? Is there wiggle room now?
Absolutely. You don't have to take the first offer. You can ask for more money as long as you have good reasons for it or special circumstances. The three ones that I like is just flat out telling the college that, you know, that that's just not a really a financial reality for us. And, you know, before we pick our school on May 1st, is there anything that you can do? Is there anything that we've missed?
So it's really worth making that call and getting personal and talking to a human being.
Absolutely. I'm also working on a case right now where the family, their income shows $106,000, but all of that money is either coming out of their IRA or it's coming out of unemployment. And unfortunately, these are just calculators that can't tell where the money's coming from. And that'd be very clear if anybody were to actually see what's going on to say this family shouldn't be paying anything. But the reality is that those calculators from the FAFSA and these other forms have calculated this family owes $22,000 a year. And what we've done is we've sent letters to these financial aid officers and made contact with them, trying to explain to them the full situation. Lastly, you know, what I try to do is I try to have the student get accepted to multiple colleges. And when we do that, we can really look at different offers and possibly tell the school that, hey, this is our dream school. But, you know, our parents, you know, this is a financial decision for them. And let's see, is there any opportunity for you to make this a reality by, you know, say, for instance, looking at the offers that we've gotten and making changes to your offer?
Trevor Ramos is a certified college planner with College Funding Remedies in Pasadena, California. Trevor, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thanks for having me.
For the past few weeks, we've been checking in on local real estate markets around the country to see if and how the recovery is taking shape on the ground. This week, the Marketplace Wealth and Poverty Desk takes us to St. Louis, where reporter Tracy Samuelson has been talking with low and moderate income families about whether or not to buy.
Buying a home is a massive, huge, ginormous, over-the-top big deal. And buying now, post-housing crisis, can be challenging. Especially for lower-income buyers.
Everyone's looking to apply for a mortgage, and credit will be evaluated. They're looking at more things than they used to. They're going to look at your bank statement so many times.
Beyond Housing, a St. Louis nonprofit, does community development and runs homebuyer education classes. Some people here know they're going to buy, and they're here to qualify for down payment assistance. Catherine Estrada, a vet technician, is not so sure.
And when I was younger, we had a great house, but unfortunately, you know, things fell through. My father lost his job, he was injured, all these other things happened.
Her family was foreclosed on in 1998 and spent a long time bumping from family member to family member, rental to rental. Now, Catherine's 22, out on her own, looking for some stability and a good investment.
I mean, I've been thinking about it for a while since everyone's like, foreclosure, oh, property this, property that. But it's like, if I get in a house and 3 years later, if I need a roof, I'm not going to be in a situation where I have to, you know, get another loan out to pay for something.
So on the one hand, there's this fear of missing out on low interest rates and low housing prices. But on the other, there's caution.
Fear and trepidation about foreclosure is higher than it's been in the past. And again, we think that's a good thing. We want people to go into this eyes wide open.
Beyond Housing CEO Chris Kraymeyer takes me on a tour of some affordable neighborhoods where the organization builds and rents homes.
So this is a little dead-end cul-de-sac.
He wants people to buy here because homeowners who are literally invested in the neighborhood can help stabilize it. But he also knows that some of the best deals right now can be risky investments. We stop in front of a brick house with beige siding that's been on the market for over a year.
From a sheer what you can buy for what you can afford, the house in and of itself is a great value. However, when you think about the neighborhood and the community, is this the place that you think is the best investment possible for you? So
the house next to it is vacant, boarded up with rotting plywood. A few houses down, there's what Kraymeyer figures is a fresh eviction.
Because all their stuff's on the curb. So again, if you're coming to buy and you pull up in this nice, quiet little cul-de-sac and you see everybody's stuff out in the front yard, it just gives you pause.
It's really difficult for a potential homeowner to know, will that nice brick house retain its value? And will that value increase over time? It's just hard to predict what will happen in a neighborhood in 5, 10 years. Plus, money that's tied up in a house can't be invested other places.
Historically, the stock market has outperformed the housing market in terms of an investment. Many people think that it's even wrong to think about a home as an investment, given the risks.
Ray Bouchara with the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis says low-income buyers need to build up savings and other investments. They shouldn't let all their money get tied up in a house. But homeownership does have its advantages.
There are tax subsidies to support homeownership for a big part of the population. And there's other evidence that when people own homes, there's other outcomes associated with that, like saving and investing. Your kids are more likely to go to college.
And while, yes, you're paying interest if you have a mortgage, making those payments each month is kind of like mandatory investing. You can't skip it if you're having a tough month like other kinds of savings.
It's forced savings. It's a forced savings plan. It requires you, by making that mortgage payment, to put that money into your house.
But ultimately, the decision to buy is part economics, part emotion. A house is an investment you can grow old in, pass on to your children. That's a big part of why home health aide Coretta Johnson wants to buy.
I just want to leave my kids something. I want to have something in my life that I said I accomplished and I did as of right now. I can't say that I can leave them anything.
Coretta already works 7 days a week, but she wants to pick up some night shifts to try and pay down a few $1,000s in credit card debt. She hopes that will help her qualify for a loan under the new tighter standards. She has to buy a home, she says. In St. Louis, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Okay, this is your third reminder. It's tax day on Monday. I'm sorry to keep hounding you. I know there are few things more divisive than taxes. Many Americans feel they pay too much and get too little in return. They feel this, but is it true? One way to look at it, take an international perspective. We asked Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, to look into how American tax rates and the return on that investment compare to other countries around the world. Derek, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Well, let's start with the straight-ahead comparison. We'll take our family of four, making a medium income in a wealthy industrialized nation like Japan or Sweden, say. What percentage of that family's income goes to the government in taxes?
Right. So if you look across all these developed economies, the OECD average for taxes as a share of the economy is about 33%. It's about a third. In the U.S., however, it's about 25%. It's considerably lower. And actually, among these developed economies, only Mexico, Chile, and Turkey have lower taxes in the U.S. as a share of our economy. So, you know, one thing to look at is, all right, where is this money coming from and where is it going? It's coming from our income and our wages. About 80% of the taxes that go to the federal government go to Social Security, or they come from federal income taxes. And so when you look at where this money is going, it's going mostly to four sorts of people: people who are sick, people who are poor, people who are retired, and people who are in the military. That right there is about 80% of the federal budget. If you look then at the state level, you've got education, K through 12 and college, Medicaid and transportation making up the bulk of spending from the taxes collected by the government.
Well, backing up for a second, are the tax rates then simply higher across the board in these countries than in the U.S., or do some of these countries have a different tax policy or different taxes? For instance, I know most industrial countries have a national consumption tax, which we don't.
Exactly right. Most developed countries have a consumption tax, sometimes called a VAT, a value-added tax. At the federal level, the U.S. does not. However, the U.S. is different from a lot of these countries we're often compared to because we have a federal government, which we talk about quite a bit, but we also have state and local governments. And consumption taxes, when you account for state and local, actually add up to about a fifth of total U.S. revenue. As a result, what you're seeing is consumption taxes at the state and local level, and then income and Social Security taxes at the federal level. So it makes country-to-country comparisons a little tricky if you just do federal government to federal government. You also have to remember that we're a nation of 50 states and many, many thousands of cities, and there are taxes at those levels as well.
And to get down to the service level, what services does that middle-class family in Japan or France or Sweden, say, receive for their money?
You look across these countries. You know, I looked at the UK, at Singapore, at Australia, even at South Africa. And one thing that you see that's really interesting is that the choices that governments make in terms of where to put money are actually remarkably similar, more similar than I thought they would be. Rich old countries tend to have the same values. They tend to spend a lot of money to help the poor, to help poor families. They tend to spend a lot of money on retirement protection, what we would call Social Security. They also tend to spend a lot of money on health care. Most developed countries have a public health care system. The government actually is a very good manager of risk. It's very good at collecting all of this money and managing the downsides that happen, the downside that people get poor, that they retire with less money than they expected, that they get much more sick than they ever expected.
Well, you're saying governments can be very good at it. The question is to what degree taxpayers trust their governments to do this, and how does that compare country to country?
I think what you're seeing right now in Washington in the debate over the budget is a fundamental debate about whether government is good at the kind of things that I said it was good at providing health care, providing risk management. And other countries are having similar debates. But it's notable, I think, that in Europe, the idea of public health care is not scary to them. In fact, it's a very old idea. It's a very conservative idea to say in Europe that we expect to pay slightly higher taxes and from that slightly higher tax base to get guaranteed public access to health care.
Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. Well, thanks for putting tax season in some perspective for us.
Cool. Thanks.
One last word, or I should say one last stanza on taxes this hour. We asked you to write in with your poems about taxes. And as always, you did not disappoint. We received more than we can share, at least on the show today. Poet Douglas Kearney has gamely agreed to join me to review your versifying. Doug is a professor of writing and critical studies at California Institute of the Arts. And it's so nice to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. I'm so happy to be here at the ground floor of this emergent genre
of poetry.
Of IRS this
poetry.
Is this is like boy, here we are.
The literary world waits with
exactly.
A bated breath. Well, before we do get to our poems, I would like to know, how would you approach the assignment of writing a poem about taxes?
Huh. I mean, you know, on one level, the idea of taxes can just be sort of metaphorized as the idea of debt, of any kind of debt or repaying what you owe.
Which is a fertile ground, right?
I mean, it's been a territory that poetry has explored for forever.
What is the artistic precedent here? You know, are there well-turned phrases, lines about taxes from famous works of poetry?
Well, you know, it was something I began thinking about, and I have to admit that what kept running into my head ahead of poetry were lines from hip-hop songs about taxes.
Oh, lay it on us. Great.
Well, there's Ice Cube's Bird in the Hand where he says, now I pay taxes. That you'll never get me back. What about diapers and bottles and Similac? This kind of sociocultural critique. Then there's also an MC from the Bay Area called Lyrics Born who has a song called Stop Complaining where he has this little riff about taxes. He says, this is fiscal harassment. They keep fondling my assets, you know, that kind of thing.
And, it's a good one. The rhyme.
The rhyme. It's built in, you know, he's staying within the field of his metaphor, extending it, building what one might call a conceit.
Well, let's see now what passion taxes inspired in our Marketplace Money listeners.
Oh, fantastic.
And we did receive a lot of poetry from all of you. Thank you so much. This one's from Kelly McIntosh of Traverse City, Michigan.
My father was an accountant. Working numbers was his trade. After years of helping him do my taxes, a tax preparer I was made. Now, without his assistance in juggling schedules A to D, I realize the knowledge he so kindly passed to me. Though filling out the tax forms isn't the most fun I've ever had, each April at tax time, I can enjoy fond memories of my dad.
Oh, so much meaning and history for her
in
tax forms.
And that also goes back to that thing I'm always talking about with debt, what we owe. There's a poem by Robert Hayden called Those Winter Sundays, where he's talking about his father doing all these things for him. And there's this really beautiful line at the end where he says, "What did I know? What did I know of love's lonely and austere offices?" I think is how it goes. And here we have this moment where the appreciation for that is actually celebrated. And Kelly is able to know that. It's a surprise in this poem. Poems are great for surprises. That's a beautiful thing.
And maybe not so much a surprise that dads come up in these poems about taxes. And we do have another poem now inspired by a male family member. And this is from Rob Jackson of Durham, North Carolina.
This poem is called Taxes. He led a revolution once. We all dream of it. There you are, standing in the back of a Jeep like Fidel, waving to people on a crowded street. You circle the post office each April 15th, honking the horn at your comrades in line, smiling and brandishing a Cohiba, blowing fat smoke rings to show them how easy it is, how little you're paying, how zero can be enough. It took years for the phone to ring with the call he dreaded, the sniper shot that left him slumped in his chair. He hung up, called a son-in-law, an accountant, and ended his resistance with payments, penalties, and pain. Most revolutions end this way. He knew that. It must have felt good for a time, though, this thrill of not paying. For a decade, he was Che. For a decade, my grandfather was king.
Here's the celebration of the kind of outlaw, which is a huge part of, you know, U.S. culture, like the person who goes against what you're supposed to do. But the irony, of course, is that eventually he will pay, and the payment will be even greater in this moment in many ways than it would have been setting up.
That's a great story. I have to admit my father also waged a protest against the IRS and would not pay his city tax and stamped his city taxes with a special stamp that he had ordered that I can't say.
I was
on
about
the
to
radio.
Say
it. It begins with the
public radio now.
Word bull.
yeah.
And there's a longer story there. Finally, we have Barbara Bowles, who so loved this Marketplace Money Challenge that she wrote not one, but three poems.
She overpaid.
That's right.
She totally
she
overpaid.
Couldn't stop. Here's just one of them.
Taxicity. We live in a state of taxicity. Acquiescent to our complicity. Torture, rape, and bombs, violence that numbs, nostalgic for unknown simplicity.
I have to say, I appreciate that rhyme, praxis with fractious.
Oh, yeah. Taxicity. So we have that fun play, the poison of taxing, right?
Oh,
taxicity,
yes.
Becomes toxicity.
Well, so much she's packed into these five lines.
Oh, yeah. The poet Tracy K. Smith, who just won the Pulitzer Prize last year for Life on Mars, talks about how we are all complicit in our comfort, you know, here with all the activities that our nation does. And here, you know, Barbara just draws that direct line with our taxes make us complicit.
Right. And a real call to awareness of what you're really doing.
Absolutely.
When you're sitting there. You're not just getting depressed about
absolutely.
Your dwindling
no,
accounts.
You know, as much as you're fixing roads and, you know, torture, rape, and bombs. That's what your taxes do.
Doug Kearney is a poet and a professor of writing and critical studies at California Institute of the Arts. And thanks a lot for playing along with us today.
Thank you. I had fun.
Say, look at this. I've been cleaning out my nest, and I found an old book of my poetry.
You can hear an extended version of my interview with Doug Kearney and more of our listeners' taxing poetic on our website, marketplacemoney.org. And that's the most poetry you might ever hear on Marketplace Money. We love to hear from you in rhyming couplets or otherwise. Write to us at marketplacemoney.org. Or you can get in touch on our Facebook page and find us on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, more than half of Americans in a new survey said they would pay more for a product with the label Made in the USA. And they weren't the only ones.
More than 60% of those in China said that they'd buy American-made version over the Chinese version if it costs more. So there's that quality perception that just transcends those of us here in the States.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Daryl Paranada. Our engineer is Jeff Peters. Our theme music was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yor. I'm Barbara Bogave. Have a great weekend, everybody.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.